kind of stuff that we're doing as an economic development tool for Portland, and we are. And because this whole area creates jobs and good jobs from working class people up through engineers. So I really appreciate the work and look forward to doing more of it. Aye.
Saul Smith.
Well, I want to thank the City-County Sustainable Development Commission for giving us their progress report, and particularly your economic development report, the World PDX, the World Sustainability Center. It's chock full of good ideas, and I appreciate the efforts. I also wanted to just thank publicly all the members of the Sustainable Development Commission, in addition to Roy and Kent and Cameron. We also have Leslie Carlson, Christine Irvin, Dennis Hopwood, Mike Houck, Chip Lazenby, Lillian Shirley, Pamela Brody Hine, and Justin Yoon, who is here in the audience today. So thank you all for your work, and I also wanted to, I also wanted to thank Michelle Krim for her staffing of this commission, I think there's a lot of good stuff in here, and as you know, this whole city council is excited about the opportunities and the challenges, and we intend to plow ahead and continue our brand Portland as the leader, the premier city in sustainability. So thanks again. Aye.
Potter.
And I, too, wanted to thank the commission. I really like your recommendations, and I think you're right, is that we need to have a regional approach on this because companies won't just be settling in Portland. We want to make sure that that this region is friendly from one end of the valley, east and west, and north and south. So really appreciate that. Also, the business-to-business connections is really important. And ensuring that we really begin to focus on retention and expansion as a community so that we attract the best and the brightest, the folks who are excited about the possibilities for the future and helping create the future right here in Portland. So thank you for all your hard work, and I know that you've got the support of this city council. I appreciate Multnomah County's participation, too. I vote aye. On item 424, need a motion to accept.
So moved.
Second.
Call the vote.
Leonard.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Move to the regular agenda. Please read item 425.
425. Tentatively deny appeal of Goose Hollow Foothills League and uphold the hearing officer's decision with modifications to approve the application of Cynthia L. Hilliard for a zoning map amendment from R7 to R2 in compliance with the existing comprehensive plan map designation of low-density multi-dwelling residential and four adjustment reviews at 1970 Southwest Mill Street Terrace.
Council has before them findings. I need a motion to adopt the findings, deny the appeal, and uphold the hearing officer's decision with modifications to approve the application.
So moved.
Second.
Please call the vote.
Leonard.
Well, what I really appreciate about this is that the Goose Hollow Foothills League and Ms. Hilliard did what exactly we hope becomes a template for other neighborhoods where these kinds of issues occur, because they do all the time. And you guys really sat down and did the right thing. And it means, I know, a lot to you, but to us as well, to not have to get in the middle of that and sort that out. So we appreciate all of the really hard work, and it was a nice outcome. Aye.
Saltzman.
I also want to appreciate the work. I also wanted to thank Kathleen Stokes for her involvement in this process, too, and bringing it to a successful conclusion. Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Please read item 426.
Authorize revenue bonds to finance costs of the Portland Mall Revitalization Project.
Staff.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, Commissioners. Eric Johansson, Debt Manager in the Office of Management Finance. This ordinance before you this morning authorizes the issuance of up to $17.2 million in limited tax revenue bonds to fund a portion of the city's costs related to the Portland Mall Revitalization Project. You may recall that under a 2004 intergovernmental agreement between the city and TriMet, the city is obligated to provide $15 million to TriMet within 60 days of the signing of the full funding and grant agreement for the project. Another $2 million will be due to TriMet near the end of the completion of the project. The full funding and grant agreement with FTA is expected to be signed this summer. Approval of this ordinance will allow the city to sell bonds in time to meet its funding obligation under the intergovernmental agreement. Debt service on the proposed bonds will be paid from parking meter revenues. In August of 2004, Council approved an increase to parking meter revenues to provide the revenues both to pay the debt service on these bonds and to fund other transportation-related projects. In addition to the parking meter revenues, the ordinance authorizes the city to pledge its full faith and credit and available general funds to the repayment of the bonds. This is being done in order to reduce the borrowing costs related to the financing. The bonds that are authorized under this ordinance are expected to be sold later on this summer, probably in July, through competitive bidding, and at which time we'll have the funds available to meet our obligations under the intergovernmental agreement. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
So when you say we're also pledging our full faith and credit,
correct,
does that mean we don't anticipate the parking revenue meters, parking meter revenue to be sufficient to pay, or is this kind of a boilerplate safeguard that goes into these things?
The concern is that we've got the parking meter revenues pledged to a number of different purposes already, including streetcar and other parking revenue bonds. Our belief is that because we would have to provide, I think, essentially a third or fourth lien on those parking meter revenues, that there may be some market resistance if we don't have the full faith and credit behind the bonds. So it's really being proposed in order to improve the marketability of the bonds, ensure that investors will look toward the ultimate security, the full faith and credit of the city, and less so on the parking meter revenues.
Other questions?
I guess I would like to see before this comes back for a second reading next week, I guess could you provide me or maybe the other council members as well?
Yes.
Yeah. What all our parking meter revenues are pledged to and
okay.
At this point.
It is a complicated picture, but we can certainly provide it.
You said third or fourth lien on the parking meters?
Correct. We haven't ever had to use the parking meters to pay debt service on any other obligations, but they are pledged in a number of different circumstances to outstanding bonds.
Surprised they're still standing.
So I guess I'd like to see that for maybe other council members.
Yeah, yes. Send it to all five offices.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that.
Sure. Try to make it simple.
We'll do.
For Dan, you could complicate it for me.
Okay, we'll do multiple copies.
Okay. Is there a sign-up sheet?
There was. No one has signed up.
Okay. It's a non-emergency. It moves to a second reading. Please read 427.
Accept bid of James W. Fowler Company for the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant Dry Weather Primary Clarifier Expansion Project for $7,399,000.
Good morning, Mayor, members of City Council. I'm Jeff Barham, the Director of the Bureau of Purchases, and before you is a purchasing agent report recommending an award of bid number 106989. To the contractor James W. Fowler Company in the amount of $7,399,000. And in this, just to sort of highlight some of the areas, we had originally looked at and identified 27 different divisions of work for potential subcontractor opportunities. And due to a variety of or a mix of the contractor self-performing some of the work, subcontracting out, and the result was that we had just a little bit above 3% for minority women and emerging small business subcontract opportunities. And as I've stated in previous occasions, when that amount is what we think to be as low, we diligently work with the contractor through the beginning of the project to look for additional opportunities. And so normally what happens during the life of the project is that number is sort of the starting point and we increase over the time of the project. So with that, I'll stop and if you have any questions.
I guess you talk about identifying 27 divisions of work as potential MWESB opportunities resulting in almost $1 million, and yet the actual award of MWESB is 3%.
Correct.
And that's almost 10%, isn't it?
Well, those are non-certified firms. So the total subcontract was $814,865 to subcontractors. Of that amount was just about $225,000 for certified firms. Certified. So the difference was non-certified firms.
Other questions? Is there anybody signed up to testify on this matter?
I didn't have a sheet.
Does anybody here wish to testify on this matter? This is report. I need a motion to accept.
So moved.
Second.
Call the vote.
Leonard.
Aye.
Salzman.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye. Please read the next.
428, adopt findings, authorize an exemption to the competitive bidding process to the Bureau of Purchases pursuant to ORS 279C.335 and City Code Title V, Section 5.34.810 and 5.34.820, and provide payment for construction of the Sandy River Conduit Relocation Project.
Mr. Leonard, did you want
to? Well, this is the a project that the Water Bureau has wanted to do for a really long time. If you'll recall, in visiting Dodge Park, these conduits are those ones you see on mm-hmm. the bridge there. It is the most vulnerable portion of the entire water system. Mm-hmm. And so Mike Stewart, our chief engineer, has really driven home the importance of burying these conduits. So I appreciate getting it to this point.
Thank you, Commissioner Mayor. I'm Jeff Baer, the Director of the Bureau of Purchases, and just shift gears a little bit. This was a project of which we had worked diligently with the Water Bureau representatives on to come up with an alternative contracting method, and that is under state law the design-build process, which we thought this was an ideal candidate for that particular type of a contract. And under Oregon law, we're required to make certain findings that really highlights two different areas. One is that the alternative method would not diminish competition, and that is we are going to still do a competitive process, a competitive request for qualifications, and come back to you with a recommendation for award of that contract. Also, that it would result in substantial cost savings, and I think Mike will talk about some of the complexities of burying that pipe or that conduit, and that there are some savings that can be achieved through having the design firm at the beginning throughout the entire life of the project. So I think the findings really support those, the alternative contracting method. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thank you. I'm Mike Stewart. I'm the chief engineer of the Water Bureau, and I have with me Tim Collins, who's our project manager for this project. Before we decided to proceed down this road to get alternative procurement, I met with Jeff Baer and Jim Van Dyke, the city's contracts attorney, because this is going to be the Bureau's first design-build project, and we wanted to make sure that we were seeking the best avenue to get this project. So Jeff has been of great help to us in deciding to pursue this course of action, and in addition, we've gone and visited other communities in the area that have done design-build work, notably King County and Seattle's doing a huge outfall project. We spent a day up there with our team looking at how they did that and why and so on. And also one of our smaller suburban neighbors, Cottage Grove, has also done a design-build in the water wastewater arena. What do we believe that we're going to get out of doing this project design build? One, we get the benefit of expertise who do tunneling for a living. You've all seen the bridges that two of our three conduits go over coming into town. Literally, two-thirds of the water that feeds our citizens comes across the Sandy River. It's a very vulnerable situation, and for flood control purposes, possible volcanic purposes, and other events that you might imagine, we want to put those things underneath the river. Our Bureau has never done a tunnel. We'll probably only do one more in my lifetime, and we need the expertise of a qualified design build contractor in order to do that in the most efficient and effective way possible. There are other things that arise from doing design build that are well documented in the literature. Because before you get the final price from the contractor, you've basically got the final design. You've done a bit of risk sharing with the designer and the contractor, and you've walked down this road together. You essentially do your value engineering before you do the final design. So you're not expending extra funds doing value engineering. It's built into the process kind of from the beginning. You always have less claims from a design build. That's been well documented in the literature, and this form of construction, because it's underground and in a tunnel, you can end up with unforeseen site conditions. And if we walk down the design road together in building the project, we think that we very much limit the possibility of unforeseen site conditions and claims that arise therefrom. So I guess to sum it up, there's several pages of findings back there, but the bottom line reason that we want to do this in this particular form is we believe that this will yield the best value for our citizens and other ratepayers in the area. So we hope you support it. Questions?
Thank you. Do you have anybody, is there a sign-up sheet?
I didn't put a sheet out for this one.
Is there anybody here who wishes to testify on this matter? Okay, it's a non-emergency and moves to a second reading. Please read item 429.
Create a local improvement district to construct street and bridge improvements from the Columbia Slough to Alderwood Road in the Northeast 92nd Drive Local Improvement District.
This item has been rescheduled till May 9th, and that day we'll hear the public testimony. Please read item 430.
Amend contract with CMTS, Inc. to supply qualified construction management, capital program management, inspection, and project support personnel.
Second reading, vote only. Please call the vote.
Leonard.
Aye.
Salzman.
Aye.
Potter.
Aye.
Please read item 431.
Accept report from the Parks Bureau on total asset management.
Commissioner Salzman.
Thank you, Mayor and Commissioner Leonard. I'm hopeful that City Council will accept the Parks reports and the attachments and endorse the Bureau's efforts here on total asset management. Substantial progress has been made in developing a comprehensive and systematic program for total asset management. This can be pretty dry stuff, but it's critically important to the future of this infrastructure Bureau. In order to meet the challenges of managing its many assets, Parks has developed a program of total asset management to assure the Bureau's portfolio meets demand, that assets are managed effectively and efficiently, and that resources are used wisely. This effort is a key part of the Parks 2020 vision, and since December of 2005, when the Bureau made its first report on this work to Council, substantial progress has been made. We have Senior Program Manager Janet Bebb and Parks Architect Nancy Gronowski here to quickly walk us through the Total Asset Management Report and the work completed to date. Janet.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mayor, we are delighted to be here with this body of work before you today. As Commissioner Salzman said, we have made progress since we were before you with our asset management approach last December. And also with our specific asset register report on major buildings and community centers. Today, we're bringing the Total Asset Management Manual, which lays out our procedures on this topic, as well as the specific asset register on our pools. And pools is a great topic, as you know. It's one of our most beloved activities. And we're pleased to show you our asset register report. Nancy will go over that. That shows that generally our nine pools examined are in very good condition. So as you know, Parks is often in front of you saying that we have issues that we need to take care of, and today we're here in front of you saying our pools are in very good condition. We're pleased to report that for you. These reports are about built assets, size, capacity, condition, replacement value, and the suitability of their intended use. And that's kind of the touchstone of our program here, is that assets are to provide services. Their value is how well they support providing service to the community. I think you'll see that pervasive in our documents. They're not about land, environmental benefits, or operating cost, which is a separate consideration. The uses of this information, I'm sure you're aware of, certainly it gets us ahead of the curve in identifying maintenance needs and lets us correct them before their emergency problems. It informs our capital planning, our budget preparation, and our forecasting, and it can inform our citywide distribution of services and how well we are delivering services with our assets. As Dan mentioned, this is part of the initiative started with the 2020 Vision Plan. Basically, I can say that there are two aspects to total asset management. One is really a technical aspect, and it is a bit dry, although for engineers it's fascinating. That's where we go out with a team of professionals and look at the condition, including the structural condition, et cetera, and we evaluate and document and keep a careful database on that information. That's the technical side, and so today you'll see number two out of a list of asset categories that we're doing that work on. The second aspect really has to do with use, and this is the preparation of management reports that have to do with topics that are of keen interest to the public, that is asset disposal, how we invest our capital, and how we manage our cultural resources. These are projects that will have a significant level of public involvement, and you'll be hearing from us on those as we work through them in 07-08. So when you think asset management, there are two aspects. One is the engineering and the evaluation side. The other is the use side. So I'll leave you with those thoughts. These documents are on the web, and our confidence in the professional level is high for these reports. I'd like to introduce Nancy Granowski, but also let you know that Nancy Roth, Portland Parks Aquatics Manager, is in the audience if you have specific questions about the pool program that we run. Nancy?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Nancy Granowski, a landscape architect and senior planner with Portland Parks. I'm going to give you a brief PowerPoint presentation and talk to you a little bit about two documents which I believe you received yesterday, the Total Asset Management Manual and the report on the aquatics facilities that were not covered in the community centers report we gave to you last year. So here's our mission, which is contributing to the city's vitality by establishing and safeguarding the parks and natural resources and urban forest, developing and maintaining excellent places for public recreation, and ensuring access to recreation service and programs. This is our planning framework, and the piece that we're talking about today are the items that are on the bottom. And these are strategies and plans which we have yet to develop, and the asset register reports which we are in the process of producing right now. And the Total Asset Management Manual is the piece that kind of ties these together. It's the guide, the how-to, in terms of developing these reports. Total asset management is a systematic process of inventory, assessment, and management. And it's specifically about built assets. As Janet mentioned, it's not about the land, although that certainly is a huge asset. It's not what asset management is about in this particular application. So the tools that we have are the manual that I mentioned. We're developing the Asset Inspection and Condition Assessment Manual. I need to get shorter titles for these things. They're kind of cumbersome, but they kind of tells you what's involved in that. There's a draft of that that's being worked on right now. The Asset Register, which is simply the full listing of our assets, and the Register Reports, which give information on the condition, value, and suitability. So the Asset Management Manual includes an introduction and overview of what asset management is, basically. It's a very comprehensive a technique that's been developed for the last few decades, primarily by colleges, university campuses, major buildings, the Army, and overseas. It's a very important part of providing the right assets to provide the services that are required. So it briefly touches on the strategy and plans, but it does not include a specific strategy or plans. It talks about what's involved in it, what the components are, and the register reports and the data that's included in the implementation as to roles and responsibilities. And as I mentioned, the register is strictly the inventory. We have organized our assets into five major groups of buildings: the amenities, which is the furnishings and recreation features; the infrastructure, which is the roads and utilities; developed landscapes, which is our trees and turf; and natural resources. So the reports are on the physical properties of the asset, particularly the condition, its suitability for its intended service, and financial information such as its current replacement value, which is useful for insurance purposes and all things, and can include a number of other things, but ours don't yet because we're just getting the basis going here. So about a year ago, we brought the first asset register report to you on the community centers and some of our arts centers, our major buildings. So let me just walk you briefly through what the information is that's in the asset register report and how we use it. So we investigated Fulton Community Center and looked at the condition of a number of major building components, its structural components, its finishes, its mechanical, electrical, all those different components, and found that there were certain areas there where there were deficiencies. And so we knew what it would cost to correct those deficiencies. And those numbers are the first three numbers, and it would be $112,000. Since then, we've already done some of those corrections. So we know what the building size is. We know what its square foot replacement value is. And then there's a metric that basically gives you a way to compare buildings to each other. So you take the total cost of the deficiencies and divide that by the current replacement value, and you come up with a number. The closer the number is to zero, the better the condition of the building. The closer it is to one, the worse condition it is. So if you had deficiencies that were equal to the value of the building, you'd go, I might as well just rebuild this thing. There's no point in just fixing it. Or you would at least take it under consideration as you thought about how do you want to handle this asset. So in this case, Fulton is in what we would call a good condition. The thing that it also tells us is it identifies emerging deficiencies. So we know that in 2010, there are a number of things that will need to be corrected for this. In this case, there were finishes and some exterior wall things that needed to happen in the finishes and some more mechanical work that needs to be done. So we can look ahead and say that in 2010, we should be thinking about budgeting for these things. If indeed we want to keep Fulton Community Center running at a good level, we know that this needs to happen. So we have these for all these buildings that we've assessed so far, which is all the community centers, and now we have all the pools. So here's our pools report, and the summary for that is that basically they're in very good condition. However, what's really important to know is that in 5 years, we can look ahead and say that we've got almost $1 million worth of investment that we need to make in these pools. And in 10 years, there's almost $1.3 million of conditions that need to be improved. So that's the value of these reports, is letting us budget and understand what the upcoming conditions are like.
Back on your last slide, is that $1.3 million in addition to the 990, or is that if the 990?
No, that's the sum. That's a cumulative total.
So another $400,000.
Correct. So here's where we are so far in all those five major categories. We have a basic inventory of everything. We're updating it because there are some things some of the information is a little old, and we want to go out and make sure that indeed we know what we've added in the last couple of years. So, and on the report status, we have completed the community centers and the aquatic facilities. We intend to get the minor buildings done. Those are all the restrooms and picnic shelters and the smaller pieces that we haven't done yet. Hopefully by the end of the summer. We're working on the amenities. We want to do some inspections this summer of the drinking fountains, park benches, picnic tables, et cetera. Hopefully get to the landscape at the same time. And infrastructure, we need to hire some consultants to help us with some road assessments. And the natural resources, the condition assessment is complete, and that's on our website. It's a very interesting website that really explains all the different parts of the natural resource areas. So to date, we've got our basic data framework completed. We've done the register reports. We've provided the facility condition index information to the city auditor. We have established an asset management steering committee made up of mostly Tier 2 people from our Parks Bureau. We've developed the manual, and we've prepared the second asset register report. So we hope to complete soon the inspection and condition assessment manual and do additional reports on paved trails. Those are being assessed right now. Complete the asset register report on buildings, do most of the amenities, assess those, and develop the scope of work so we can move ahead on that piece. Thank you.
I do have a question about the pools. Mm-hmm. Are any of them solar heated? I'm not thinking like the expensive solar cells, but, you know, a lot of homeowners use what I think is
Wilson.
Wilson, our most recently renovated pool, does have solar heating. And I believe, Nancy, can you explain how much of the heating is provided by the solar energy?
It's only on one pool. It's on our lap pool. And then we found that it was such a...
Why don't you come on up?
Ahead, come up here.
I'm Nancy Roth. I'm the aquatic director. We found that it was, we only had money for one pool, so we put it on our lap pool, but we found that the lap pool was very warm with the solar heat, so we have put in plumbing and a valve to, now we can change it to the leisure pool as well.
I think the other one is that as we build East Portland Aquatic Center, we're looking at a partnership that will get us some solar capacity on that one.
So to follow up on the one that you have, so you have an idea of how warm can be, and I'm assuming that that more than satisfies the need to heat, right? You don't have to augment that pool.
I think it is. We purchased steam from the school, from Wilson School. So I'm not sure. I'm not the heating specialist, but
normally in my experience with people I know that have pools, that's all they need.
Yeah.
So the question I'm asking is, have you done a cost benefit analysis to see how much you have saved by not having to typically or traditionally heat the pool versus the cost of installing the solar system?
I believe we have. I don't have those numbers.
That has been done. I've seen those numbers. I don't know what they are off the top of my head.
So, of course, the corollary to that is, does that make the case, and I'm assuming it does, that it would be a wise investment on our part, on the city's part, to come up with dollars to do that at all the pools, knowing that it will dramatically reduce the maintenance costs that they pay for themselves. Did you get that out of what you saw?
The initial information, and again, this has probably been up now for a little over a year.
This will be our second summer, third summer.
The initial information, as I recall, was it was very effective for heating the lap pool, right? So that's a good question. I mean, we are, as Janet said, for the East Portland pool, I think we're looking at even more ambitious solar heating. I think there may even be some solar electric in that discussions. We're working with
We'd be happy to take a look again at what this means for outdoor pools.
Yes.
And the outdoor pools, to me, intuitively has more potential. We did an analysis early on indoor pools, and we're going to test pilot East Portland. But indoor pools may be a bit of more of a challenge because of the year-round use and the climate considerations.
Could be, but there's ways to get. But I want to emphasize what I'm describing isn't high tech. I'm describing a really very inexpensive, low tech methods. But I mean, I've seen people do something as low tech as put black pipe on their roofs.
Right.
And I'm not describing that, but there are certainly panels that don't have the expensive solar cells, but actually literally have been designed in a way to cap the glass captures the heat, and there's nothing but a series of piping that goes through them. So I'm thinking as big as our pools are, and as much as they, because I noticed you heat them to 84 degrees so that it's comfortable for people,
which makes sense.
But it seems to me we might be able to save a lot of money in a short, recover the cost in a short period of time of doing this kind of even low-tech approach to heat the pools versus using traditional
fuel. We'd be happy to take a look at that and what it would mean for the system and include that consideration and come back to you on that.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Yeah.
Do you cover the pools when they're not in use to keep the heat in?
No. Not at this time. We don't. Go ahead. We have used pool covers in the past at that time. They were hard on our lifeguards. We had a lot of injuries because they are hard to pull on and pull off. We are experimenting with a liquid pool cover, which is an kind of an alcohol-based system that gets pumped into our pools at night. So it's on a timer and has a pump.
Don't tell the kids that.
and so it covers the pool and saves heat. And so we have that on our Selwood pool, which is one of our largest outdoor pools, and we put that on at the end of the summer. So hopefully this summer we'll have some data on how much heat we save.
Yes, I drove by Selwood the other day. I did see it was covered, but I'm just wondering if...
Yes, Selwood is covered during the off-season because it's a plaster pool. We have to keep it full with water.
That's good. I do think, you know, the potential for solar heating is probably great. And gets
of course, the overheating is addressable by simple little things like a thermostat that automatically shuts it down when it gets too warm. I mean, this technology isn't like some others that one reads about in terms of you were talking about generating power. That's not what this is. This is a very inexpensive and old technology that I wouldn't think would be so expensive that we shouldn't do it, even if it means we came up with extra funds on the idea that I'm sure it will dramatically drop the maintenance or the heating costs of the pools.
As I recall, the Wilson student body presented us a check for $5,000 to help us do the solar for the Wilson pool.
Right, and it's an area where grant funding is available, which we're pursuing with East Portland.
Mm-hmm. Energy Trust of Oregon is very excited about these things, and they're working with us.
Other questions? Thank you, folks. Is there a sign-up sheet?
There is, and we have Amanda Fritz and Shannon Locke signed up.
Thanks for being here, folks. When you speak, please state your name for the record. You each have 3 minutes.
Good morning. I'm Amanda Fritz, speaking only for myself, and I thank the park staff for their diligent work. Most of this report is very good. My concern is on pages 35 and 36 regarding assets disposal. And I'd like to start by drawing attention to an email sent to you by Linda Robinson, East Portland Parks Advocate, in which she says, I first learned that Parks was working on an asset management strategy last month and sent an inquiry to Parks asking if the strategy would include anything about disposal of land. She was referred to Nancy Gronowski, who assured her that while the asset management strategy will include a section on asset disposal, it will relate to built assets, not land, and we won't do the asset disposal plan until we have developed a service delivery strategy. However, in reading pages 35 and 36 of the asset management report, Linda sees nothing that indicates this asset disposal section is referring only to built assets, not land. If it only refers to built assets, this limitation needs to be stated very clearly in the report. Even if it only applies to built assets, we still hope that the process of declaring a building or other major asset surplus and determining how to dispose of it would be based on more than the two factors mentioned in the report, which are a detailed assessment of the assets identified as surplus and analysis of how to dispose of them in full knowledge of prevailing market conditions and government. Linda concludes, this report is dated in July 2006, so obviously there have been numerous delays bringing it to council. I urge you to delay it again by sending it back to Parks with instructions for them to conduct a broader public discussion about the asset disposal section. And I'm very concerned about the two criteria and the two standards for determining about assets disposal. It should also reference the need for an open public process and to determine support for a supermajority of the City Council, unless of course, Measure 2691 passes. Even then, 3 of 5 city commissioners would have to vote to declare a property surplus. The report should state that. Fundamentally, I believe that the report should state that assets disposal is not something which should be done quickly or without public interest. And I ask you to send the report back to Parks for more public input into the policy for assets disposal.
Shannon Locke, and I'm here in support of Parks, and I'm representing the 400-plus people who have signed petitions opposing the sale, lease, or private development of any part of Mount Tabor Park, including the central maintenance yard and the nurseries. This report has not been adequately reviewed by the public, and when so much park maintenance is deferred, this report codifies a process to potentially sell parkland without adequate public process. Currently, Parks is in mediation about asset management and the lack of public process, and this is regarding around the sale of the Mount Tabor Park Yard for private development. This notebook is a record of the facts and information that was compiled for the mediation process, and the documents here were requested from Parks under the Freedom of Information Act. In this process, it was discovered that the plant nurseries at Mount Tabor and the horticultural services are also being eliminated as a part of a complete reorganization that's been going on within Parks. This has happened without any public review, and the sale of the yard, the elimination of the nursery, and the horticultural services being discontinued are part of a new direction that's happened with this reorganization and that's accelerating the commercialization and privatization of our parklands. I would respectfully ask the City Council to provide an opportunity for the public to review the reorganization that's taken place at Parks over the last several years and is resulting in actions such as the selling off of significant and historic parkland without any public process, and reports such as this asset management plan, which appear to be the same outcome-based management style that resulted in the maintenance facility report that came before Council this fall, and that was in part written with an apparent effort to provide a reason to sell the yard. Please don't accept this report until a service delivery plan is completed, as this is part of the criteria for evaluating land for disposal. And lastly, I would ask the Council not to consider any new park policy, particularly regarding assessment or asset management and disposal, until the mediation between the parks and the community is finished. Thank you.
That's all? Okay, further questions? Need a motion to accept?
So moved. Second.
Please call the vote.
Leonard.
Well, I do appreciate an approach that creates a methodical approach to managing our valuable park assets. The parks are probably of any of the services provided to Portlanders, with the exception of emergency services, the most significant thing that makes Portland. And thus, I feel very passionate about our parks and the way they're managed. And maybe at times overly so, but that's a reflection of how committed I am to them being well-funded, well-managed. And I want this report to be implemented in that vein. I have looked through it. If I thought that there was a concern that it somehow created an opportunity for the disposal of parks that didn't include the input of the council, I would not support it. I'm saddened that we're at the point where we actually have to mediate differences. I think people should be able to sit down and discuss them in a way that doesn't require mediation, but apparently that's not possible here. I do, as I've said many times here before, commit myself to doing what's in the best interest of the parks, and I've learned that's not always the most popular thing to do with park advocates. But it is why I'm here, and I do ask questions that sometimes I think in the past maybe have not been asked of one another's portfolios, but I think that that's a good thing. I think it's healthy, and my goal is in the long term to have Portland have the best system of parks and the best management as is possible. Aye.
Saul Smith.
Well, I think this report reflects, and the associated asset register report for pools reflects, as was said in this presentation, sort of, you know, the state of the art, looking at our infrastructure and making sure that we are devoting resources in a timely manner to prevent things from getting to the point of no return. And I'm pleased to see that our pools are in good shape. I think there is a solar angle we need to look at more aggressively. I think issues around asset disposal, I mean, asset disposal is part and parcel of any comprehensive asset management plan, is it's got to be looked at. But by the same token, there's nothing on the table being suggested, and nothing would be without being subject to, a public review process or public involvement and council involvement. So I believe this is a good report, and please to support it, and want to thank park staff for a good job. Aye.
Potter.
And I want to thank the park staff, too, because I think that's one of the things that the city really needs to improve is its asset management planning. And I think by having this total asset management plan outline, I really think that it will help bring to the attention of the city council the condition of our assets citywide. I'd like to see all of the infrastructure bureaus move towards a total management asset, because that would be helpful, I believe, to council in determining what size reserves or we should have in terms of capital, rebuilding capital, our capital assets. I also share the concern that I would like to see in the asset disposal a public process specifically mentioned rather than just being inherent, so that it's actually outlines the steps that would be taken to ensure that there was sufficient public discussion on that. But I think it's an excellent document. I'm very proud to support it, and I vote aye. We're recessed until 2 p.m. tomorrow.